Radio Free Maine presents Noam Chomsky, speaking on education and democracy, March 28, 1995, Michigan State University, recorded for Radio Free Maine by Roger Leisner. We now join Sheldon Axler as he introduces Noam Chomsky.
Noam Chomsky is the most influential linguist ever. His work in linguistics, philosophy, and psychology have brought him many honors and awards, including the 1989 Kyoto Prize and the Distinguished Scientific Contribution Award of the American Psychological Association. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and of the National Academy of Sciences. According to the Arts and Humanities Citation Index, Noam Chomsky is the eighth most cited source in scholarly papers in the arts and humanities. Others in the top 10 include Shakespeare, Marx, and Freud, but no living person is cited as frequently as Noam Chomsky. In addition to his distinguished career as a linguist, Noam Chomsky is, in my opinion, the most perceptive and important dissident political analyst in the United States. His accurate and incisive writings during the American-Vietnamese War helped fuel one of the largest anti-war movements in history. While most critics base their opposition on the war to its supposed unwinnability, Chomsky's stance was based on a principled opposition to aggression, including American aggression. Liberal critics wrote that the war arose from a series of errors and misunderstandings. Noam Chomsky's brilliant historical analyses expose the real motives behind American foreign policy. His electrifying 1967 book, American Power and the New Mandarins, was dedicated, quote, to the brave young men who refused to serve in a criminal war. Noam Chomsky's political activities earned him an honored place on President Nixon's enemies list. As Chomsky began writing about other aspects of American foreign policy, his voice became rare in American mass media. For example, the ideas and facts between Chomsky's scathing critique of our government's support for Israel do not receive coverage in the respectable organs of political reporting. Chomsky countered with a string of dazzling books analyzing our political culture, our foreign policy, and our mass media. I especially recommend his books, The Political Economy of Human Rights, Towards a New Cold War, The Fateful Triangle, the U.S., Israel, and the Palestinians, Turning the Tide, The Culture of Terrorism, Manufacturing Consent. By the way, that's also the title of a film made by the National Film Board of Canada about Noam Chomsky and the mass media. Some of you may have seen it at the Odeon Theater here in town. Continuing with the list of Chomsky's books that I found most interesting, Necessary Illusions, Deterring Democracy, Year 501, The Conquest Continues, World Orders, Old and New, and my personal favorite among the recent books, Rethinking Camelot, JFK, the Vietnam War, and U.S. Political Culture. This evening, Noam Chomsky will be speaking to us on the topic of education and democracy. We will have a question and answer session following the talk. Please welcome Noam Chomsky.
The title of the talk is stolen shamelessly from one of the most outstanding thinkers of the past century, John Dewey, who devoted a good part of his life and thought to the array of issues that fall under those two words. For a good part of his life, he became more skeptical later on, but for most of his life, Dewey seems to have believed that reforms in early education would be in themselves a major lever of social change and would lead the way to a more just and free society, a society, in his words, in which the ultimate aim of production is not production of goods, but the production of free human beings associated with one another on terms of equality. Now, this basic commitment, which runs through his life and work, was profoundly at odds with the leading currents of 20th century social intellectual life and structure, and those three major dominant currents are fascism, the command societies of Eastern Europe, and the state capitalist industrial societies of the West, the United States included, which are under the effective rule of unaccountable private power. Now, these three systems were similar and have been similar. Two of them have eroded. One is alive and well. They're quite similar in fundamental ways, more so than is commonly believed, even, in my opinion, even ideologically. Actually, they grew out of the same intellectual roots, late 19th century Hegelian ideas about organic entities having rights over and above individuals. It's out of that background that Bolshevism and fascism developed, and also corporations, which are, contrary to what's commonly believed, a pretty modern innovation. They were established in their current form by courts and lawyers, not by legislation, early in this century. And in fact, the roots are very similar. There's some interesting recent historical work on this, if you want to look into it, by a leading legal historian, Morton Horowitz, at the Harvard Law School, who's discussed these backgrounds in two recent scholarly books. And it's quite interesting and, I think, quite correct. These three systems, all deeply authoritarian and fundamental commitments, they are opposed to another tradition, a sort of more libertarian tradition, which goes right back to the Enlightenment. And it included progressive liberals like John Dewey, independent socialists like Bertrand Russell. It included the anti-Bolshevik sectors of the Marxist left, which in fact was the leading element of it up until the Bolshevik Revolution. And of course, it included various anarchist currents. It also included a very interesting and largely forgotten popular movement in the United, not even movement, just popular expression in the United States of the working class press, independent working class press, which existed for quite a long time. It was lively, vibrant tradition. It finally succumbed in the 1950s to unremitting private power with which it couldn't compete. But as late as the 1950s, there were hundreds, maybe 800 or so labor newspapers still reaching 20 or 30 million people, also radio stations and some television, but advertising pressure and capital resources just drove them off. Same thing happened in England about 10 years later. If you go back to the 19th century and the early 20th century, it was roughly on the scale of the private capitalist press, very lively, very interesting and independent and mostly forgotten, but real in the real world. These traditions, I think, are, I think, a direct line from the Enlightenment right through classical liberalism right into these various directions. And I think it stands opposed to the absolutist currents that have reigned pretty much in the 20th century, those of state socialism and state capitalism, including the rather extreme form of absolutism that's now masked under the phrase conservative, this being terminology that would have, I think, amused Orwell and scandalized Adam Smith. Well, I don't have to stress that this picture that I've very briefly sketched is not precisely the orthodox one. And for that reason alone, it should be viewed with skepticism and a critical eye, and that's what I'd recommend. But I would nevertheless like to argue that it has the merit of accuracy, and that if you look at it closely, you'll find that it's true, or so I will try to show. Let me return to Dewey's central theme, and again urge that it be taken quite seriously, that is, that the ultimate aim of production is not production of goods, but the production of free human beings associated with one another on terms of equality. The real goal of education, as Bertrand Russell put it, is to give a sense of the value of things other than domination, to help create wise citizens of a free community, to encourage a combination of citizenship with liberty in individual creativeness, which means that we treat, I'm still quoting, we regard a child as a gardener regards a young tree, as something with an intrinsic nature, which will develop into an admirable form given proper soil and air and light. And much as they disagreed on many other matters, as they did, Dewey and Russell, who are certainly two of the leading figures in the intellectual life of the 20th century, they did agree on this humanistic conception, as Russell put it, with its roots in the Enlightenment, which expressed, where it was common to express the thoughts in very similar words, the idea that, for example, to cite one British Enlightenment thinker, that that education is not to be viewed as something like filling a vessel with water, but rather as helping a flower to grow in its own way by providing the circumstances in which the normal creative powers will flourish. Dewey and Russell also shared the understanding that these leading ideas of the Enlightenment and of classical liberalism retained their revolutionary character, and if they were implemented, they might indeed produce free human beings whose values are something other than accumulation and domination, rather free association on terms of equality, sharing, and cooperation, participating in equal terms to achieve common goals, democratically conceived, and with only contempt for what Adam Smith denounced as the vile maxim of the masters, all for ourselves and nothing for anyone else, the guiding principle that we are now taught to revere as traditional values have eroded under unremitting attack from absolutist tendencies that have become dominant. Well, it's worth tarrying for a moment to consider just how sharp and dramatic is the clash of values from between, on the one hand, the humanistic conception that runs from the Enlightenment right through to 20th century figures like Russell and Dewey, and on the other hand, the prevailing doctrines of today, which are indeed the doctrines that Adam Smith bitterly denounced as the vile maxim of the masters. And were also denounced in pretty much the same terms by the independent popular press, working class mostly press, lively and vibrant working class press of the 19th century, which condemned what it called the new spirit of the age, gain wealth, forgetting all but self. That's Smith's vile maxim. It's remarkable to trace the evolution of values from a pre-capitalist thinker like Adam Smith, with his stress on sympathy, on the goal of perfect equality, on the basic human right to creative work, and then on to the present, to those who laud the new spirit of the age, sometimes invoking Smith's name. For example, Nobel Prize winning economist James Buchanan, who writes in a recent book that what each person seeks is an ideal situation is mastery over a world of slaves. And it's only if we accept that fundamental principle that we can sort of spin out the rest of economic theory. That's you, in case you didn't notice it. That's something that Adam Smith would have regarded as completely pathological. I think there's no doubt about that. The fact that Smith's name is invoked to present those theses is a sign of the intellectual degeneration of the age, quite apart from what you think about the moral level. The new spirit of the age had to be imposed by force. It wasn't easy to impose. In fact, it's been about a century and a half of struggle to drive it down people's throats, and it hasn't quite made it yet. That fact ought to be familiar from our own history. Unfortunately, it isn't, but it's a major theme of American history, as it was a major theme of the history of England before us. Modern America was created over the protests of its working people, as the distinguished Yale historian, labor historian, David Montgomery points out in a recent book quite correctly, and those protests were vigorous and outspoken, in particular in the popular press, which flourished from the around 1840, you know, that part of the 19th century, right up to the 1950s. Finally, there's a source that one can look at. It's been very hard to get access to this. The major book on it was published in 1924 by Norman Ware, who's the first modern labor historian, but it's been out of print forever. It just was reprinted, and it's, I think, very worth reading. It's mostly quotes from the 19th century working class press. And remember, that was very substantial in scale. It was completely independent. It was just written by working people. Much of it edited and run by women, in fact, what were called the factory girls in Lowell, Massachusetts, and so on, and all over the place, from the beginning of the American Industrial Revolution up until it finally was killed off. I think one learns quite a lot from reading it about this spontaneous, essentially untutored, spontaneous reactions to the growing tide of capitalist authoritarianism, which was dominant across the working class, ordinary working people, until finally it was either beaten out of their heads or just silenced by bigger concentrations of power. Not that far back, in fact. The book's now again in print, and I think you can learn a lot about it from it about human nature, in fact, how it reflects itself when the new spirit of the age was imposed on it, on people. The themes that run through it, I'll just quote some standard phrases that run through this whole period, are protest against what people called degradation, loss of dignity and independence, loss of self-respect, the decline of the worker as a person, the sharp decline in cultural level and attainments, which is a very striking fact, as workers were subjected to what they called wage slavery, not much different, they claimed, than the chattel slavery that they had fought to overcome during the Civil War. Particularly dramatic and actually relevant today is the very sharp decline in high culture. These are mostly people without much formal education, but they were very much immersed in the high culture of the day. So the factory girls of Lowell, you know, young women from farms who came to the mills, they were reading and expected to be reading contemporary literature and classics. Artisans, if they had a little bit of money, would say a shoemaker or something, would hire young boys to read to them while they worked, and they would be reading modern literature. And this runs right at least into the 1930s. I can remember it very well from my own family, mostly unemployed first-generation immigrants without much formal education or even any in some case, but right in the middle of New York City high culture, right into the late 1930s. It took a long time to drive all of that out of people's heads. It wasn't easy. But it's been achieved, and not in the very recent past. That's also worth recalling. In their own words again, the working class press wrote that when you sell your product, you retain your person, but when you sell your labor, you sell yourself. You lose your rights as a free man, and you become the vassal of mammoth establishments, of a moneyed aristocracy that threatens annihilation to anyone who questions their right to enslave and oppress. Those who work in the mills ought to own them, the factory worker said back in the early 19th century. They should not have the status of machines ruled by private despots who are entrenching monarchic principles on democratic soil. This is not so long after the Democratic Revolution of the 18th century, and the idea that monarchic principles should be reestablished on democratic soil was intolerable. As these private despots drive downward freedom and rights, civilization, health, morals, and intellectuality in their new commercial feudalism. The labor press also condemns what they call the bought priesthood of the media, universities, and the intellectual class, the apologists who sought to justify what this absolute despotism that was the new spirit of the age and to instill its sordid and demeaning values. One of the early leaders of the AFL, about a century ago, that's, remember, the more conservative part of the labor movement, one of the early leaders of the AFL in the around 1890 expressed the common view when he described the mission of the emerging labor movement, fighting bitter hostility and huge violence. I mean, it was way beyond anything in Europe. He described its mission as to overcome the sins of the market and defend democracy by extending it to control over industry by working people. And it, again, was not until the 1950s that the democratic culture succumbed to a huge corporate offensive, barely known, but there was an enormous propaganda offensive, business-based propaganda offensive in the early and through the 1950s, actually reached the point just to drive out of people's heads the idea that you could have a democratic culture of the kind I've just described. It got to the point where about a third of the textbooks in American schools were just paid for and given by, they were, you know, corporate textbooks. They had gotten to, by the early 1950s, to having 20 or 30 million people a week watch business propaganda. The Taft-Hartley bill gave management the right to propagandize workers in the workplace. That had been illegal under the Wagner Act as an unfair labor practice, and that meant that working people in their place of work were deluged by propaganda. There were what were called business education industry days when the schools were called off so that everybody could be properly propagandized. Lansing, Michigan was one of the places where that happened. You know, teachers were taken to be given the word by corporate executives, and school children were told what to do, and so on. It was a huge, well-organized corporate offensive, and you learn a lot about the bought priesthood from the fact that it's not studied. This is a major phenomenon of modern America, just as the working-class press is a major phenomenon of America in the 19th and early 20th century, and the first book on it just came out, first academic book, just came out about 2 months ago. University of Illinois Press did the first American study of the huge corporate propaganda offensive called Selling Free Enterprise through the 1950s as business sought to drive down and destroy the democratic culture that had in fact emerged in the 1930s and the through the wartime period. These are facts of major significance and not talked about very much, which tells you something too. Well, all of these ideas kind of just sampled, which just come out of ordinary working people putting together their own thoughts, expressing them, and so on, without any tutelage or anything else. And they're very similar all the way through. And these, I think, would have been completely intelligible to founders of classical liberalism, people like Adam Smith, or his contemporary, Wilhelm von Humboldt in Germany, who inspired John Stuart Mill, and who, like Smith, regarded creative work freely undertaken in association with others as the core value of a human life. As von Humboldt, these are the classics of classical liberalism. As he put it, if a person produces an object on command, we may admire what he did, but we will despise what he is. And for similar reasons, Adam Smith warned that in any civilized society, the government would have to intervene to prevent the division of labor, which he opposed, contrary to what's believed, and the government would have to do that in a civilized society in order to prevent division of labor from turning people into, as he put it, creatures as stupid and ignorant as it's possible for a human being to be. That is the obvious result of division of labor, which will turn someone into, you know, just a machine, maybe we'll admire what he does, but we'll despise what he is in the classical liberal terms. Smith, for similar reasons, based his rather nuanced advocacy of markets. He did advocate markets, but in a pretty complex way and a nuanced way, and he based it on the principle that under conditions of perfect liberty, markets would lead to perfect equality, and that was the moral justification for them. The idea that you either have, you know, equality or markets, that's a modern idea, strenuously opposed by Smith, and if he had believed that was true, he would have opposed markets based on his own principles. These are major ideas of the classics, which have not only been forgotten, but indeed grossly distorted in the contemporary culture as it reconstructs them. You can find it out. The texts are available. Here are the same thoughts were commonly expressed. So de Tocqueville and his famous Democracy in America, another standard thing that you're supposed to name but not read, he was particularly struck by what he called the equality of condition in America and regarded that as a prerequisite for democracy, as distinct from Europe, where there were sharp distinctions in condition and status and wealth, and therefore democracy was impossible. Here he echoed von Humboldt and Adam Smith, and in fact the labor press at the same time, in describing wage labor and division of labor as degrading, dehumanizing to the laborer. De Tocqueville's phrase was that art advances, but the artisan recedes. That's the same point that Smith and von Humboldt and other classical liberals are making when they oppose wage labor. Thomas Jefferson, the leading Enlightenment figure in the United States, along with Benjamin Franklin, who took exactly the same view, Jefferson argued that, it, as he put it, dependence will lead to subservience and venality and will suffocate the genius of virtue. And remember, by dependence, he meant wage labor. That was the meaning of dependence. So when he talked about dependence leading to venality and subservience and suffocating the germs of virtue, germs, not genius, the germs of virtue, he was talking about wage labor, which was considered an abomination under classical liberal principles. Now, there's a modern perversion of conservatism and libertarianism, which has changed the meanings of words, pretty much the way Orwell discussed. So nowadays, dependence refers to something else. When you listen to what's going on in Congress and people talk about dependence, what they mean by dependence is public support for hungry children, not wage labor. That's dependence. Dependence is support for hungry children and mothers who are caring for them. And in a further vulgarization, which is typical of the new spirit of the age, mothers who care for children are not doing work. Therefore, they have to be driven into the workforce. That's taken for granted by anyone. Taking care of a child is not working. That's a very intriguing, it's an intriguing property of our culture. It reveals, it's a highly ideological, very fanatic intellectual culture where people can even say these things without collapsing in ridicule, but they're said without comment. Mothers taking care of children are not doing work. So we compare child care with real work, awarded and is therefore socially useful by our criteria, like speculating against currencies in an effort to drive growth rates down. That's work, but not taking care of children. And those, incidentally, are the values. It's not in question. These are the values, because we're supposed to measure social utility by economic return, and if you're just taking care of a child, you get no economic return, but furthermore, you're not even working, so you have to be driven to the workforce. On the other hand, if you're moving $1 trillion a day around to try to drive down growth rates by speculating against currencies, that's real work, and you make a huge amount of money from it. Well, those are the values. This is part of something more general. The idea that raising children comes free is just an aspect of a more general principle that traditional women's work altogether comes free. These ideas are incredible, even on the narrowest economic grounds. I mean, any economic theory, play the whole Chicago school game or whatever you like, that talks about human capital and not people and, you know, the whole business. It's totally insane on these grounds. I mean, everyone understands that the major, you know, a major factor contributing to economic growth, however measured, is what's called human capital, you know, human capacity to do things. Well, where does that come from? Well, you know, it comes from mothers taking care of children, but that's not work. So you got to stop it and drive them into the workforce. Those are the principles of the new spirit of the age, and they're pretty astonishing when you look at them on any terms. Even if you accept the whole ideological framework, they range somewhere between unimaginable and lunatic. I don't know exactly where to place them, but somewhere around there. Well, Dewey, and it's a sign of what's happened since the 18th century, since, say, Adam Smith and Thomas Jefferson, that this passes without comment. Dewey and Russell were two of the leading 20th century inheritors of this tradition, with its roots in the Enlightenment and classical liberalism, and in the quite inspiring record of struggle and organization and protest by working men and women since the early 19th century, as they sought to win freedom and justice and to retain the rights that they once had had as this new despotism of state-supported private power extended its sway, particularly in the early 20th century when it took on the corporate form. And I stress again, that's an analog to fascism and Bolshevism and came from the same roots, and is in some ways even grander now that it's transnational in scale. The basic issue was formulated quite clearly by Thomas Jefferson. That was before the Industrial Revolution had really taken roots in the former colonies. In his later years, Jefferson lived till, I think, 1826, and towards the end of his life, he was observing what was happening, and he had rather serious concerns about the fate of the democratic experiment for which he was the leading intellectual spokesman and major Enlightenment figure. He feared that the rise of a new form of absolutism, which he considered as being more ominous than the form of absolutism that the American Revolution 50 years earlier had overthrown. And in writing about this in his last years, he distinguished between what he called aristocrats and democrats. Aristocrats, he said, are those who fear and distrust the people and wish to draw all powers from them into the hands of the higher classes, in particular moneyed banking institutions and moneyed in corporations, what we would nowadays call corporations. That was just on the future, and he warned specifically against that. So that's the aristocrats. The democrats, in contrast, in his words, identify with the people, have confidence in them, cherish and consider them as the honest and safe depository of the public interest, even if not only the most wise, always the most wise. Well, the aristocrats of his day were the advocates of the rising capitalist state with, and remember, the United States had a developmental state. The U.S. invented the concept of state protection of industry and state subsidy for development. That, you know, dismissing any free market nonsense. That's a U.S. invention, and other developing societies have done pretty much the same thing, in fact, without exception. The British, of course, did it before us, but the U.S. did it par excellence, and it retains that right up to the present, incidentally. He saw that happening. He saw the beginnings of publicly subsidized private power developing. And those were the aristocrats. He, of course, Jefferson regarded this with a good deal of disdain, and he recognized the perfectly obvious contradiction between democracy and capitalism, or more accurately, between democracy and what you might call really existing capitalism that is guided and subsidized by a powerful developmental state. That's a fundamental contradiction. And it just increased as corporate structures were granted increasing powers, primarily early in this century, not by democratic procedures, but by courts and lawyers, who turned these banking institutions and moneyed in corporations, of which Jefferson warned, into immortal persons with powers and rights beyond the worst nightmares of pre-capitalist thinkers like Adam Smith or Thomas Jefferson. And again, that's fairly recently. We tend to think of it as sort of like immutable truth, but it's early in this century. Jefferson's distinction between aristocrats and Democrats was developed further about a half a century later by Bakunin, anarchist thinker. This is one of the few predictions of the social sciences that has ever come true. It should have a place of honor in every curriculum for that reason alone, I think. Bakunin predicted that the rising intelligentsia, the sort of what he called the new class of intellectuals who were kind of coming into existence in that period, the early modern period, he said the rising intelligentsia, he predicted, will follow one of two quite parallel paths. This is around the middle of the last century. He said they will either exploit popular struggles to take state power, becoming what he called a red bureaucracy that will impose the most cruel and vicious regime in history, or they will see that real power lies elsewhere and they will become its bought priesthood, in the words of the labor press at the same time, serving the real masters in the state-supported private systems of power, either as managers or apologists, who beat the people with the people's stick, in his words, in the state capitalist democracies. Well, as I say, that's one of the few predictions that I know of any scale that's actually worked out, and it's pretty accurate about the 20th century. Independently of Jefferson and Bakunin, others were coming to the same understanding, though drawing quite different conclusions from it. Now we're getting into the mainstream of American thought. So far I've been talking about the periphery, people like Adam Smith and Jefferson who were strongly opposed to what was going on. But let's take, you know, the ones in the middle, like the leading American intellectual Charles Francis Adams in 1880, so you know, a little over a century ago. He described the rise of what is now called post-industrial society by Daniel Bell and John Kenneth Galbraith and Robert Reich and others. This is a society, he didn't use the term, but it's the same thing. It's a society in which the future, in his words, is in the hands of our universities, our schools, our specialists, our scientific men, and our writers, and those who do the actual work of management in the ideological and economic institutions. Nowadays, they're called the technocratic elite or the action intellectuals or some other term. Adams concluded that the first object of the thinking citizen now should be not to keep one political party or other in power, but to insist on order and submission to law, meaning that these new rising elites should be permitted to function in what, to borrow some current World Bank lingo, is called technocratic isolation, protected from popular pressures. And that's a very standard view now in those who pass themselves off as free market Democrats. So take, say, the London Economist, which is maybe one of the leading journals, as it describes the ideal today, policy should be insulated from politics. Okay, so leaders, elites, should be able to work in technocratic insulation independently from any games that people play in the public arena. That's another leading component of the new spirit of the age, and we're getting pretty close to it. A decade earlier, in 1870, Adams had warned against universal suffrage. There was very limited suffrage at that time. He warned against universal suffrage on the grounds that it would bring, he said, a government of ignorant and vice, with power in the hands of a European and especially Celtic proletariat on the Atlantic coast. Remember, Ireland was being depopulated by one of these free market experiments with its usual consequences, you know, genocide and so on. We would get this Celtic proletariat on the Atlantic coast, an African proletariat on the shores of the Gulf, and a Chinese proletariat on the Pacific. He didn't foresee the sophisticated techniques that would be developed in the 20th century to ensure that policy remains insulated from politics, as the franchise was indeed extended through a lot of popular struggle, but with various techniques to guarantee that the public would remain marginalized and disaffected, subdued by the new spirit of the age, and coming to see themselves not as free people who have a right to dignity and independence, but as atoms of consumption who sell themselves on the labor market. If they're lucky, a lot of populace do what they're told. Adams wasn't innovating. He was expressing ideas that go right back to the founding fathers, notably Alexander Hamilton, whose view was, as he put it, that your people is a great beast, and the real disease is democracy. These ideas became ever more entrenched in educated circles as Jefferson's fears and Bakunin's predictions were increasingly realized. Coming to the modern period, these same ideas were expressed quite clearly and lucidly by Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State, Robert Lansing. We're now talking about what's called Wilsonian idealism in American ideological doctrine. So according to Wilsonian idealism, as expressed by Robert Lansing, these are incidentally the attitudes that animated Wilson's Red Scare, which destroyed the labor movement and independent thought for a decade, with the support of the liberal press and so on. Lansing warned of the danger of allowing the ignorant and incapable mass of humanity to become dominant in the earth, or even influential, as he mistakenly believed that the Bolsheviks intended in the hysterical and wholly erroneous reaction that standard among people who feel that their power might be threatened. These concerns, deep anti-democratic, anti-popular concerns, going right back to the origins of the Republic. There was a real split between the Hamiltonian and Jeffersonian view, and the Hamiltonian one prevailed. These concerns were articulated very clearly in that, at that time, by one of the leading progressive intellectuals of the day, Walter Lippmann. He was a major political commentator and commentator on world affairs in the sort of liberal progressive tradition right into the 1960s. But in the 1920s, he wrote what are called his progressive essays on democracy, expressing Wilsonian idealism. He advised, in his words, that the public must be put in its place so that the responsible men may live free of the trampling and the roar of a bewildered herd. In a democracy, he said, these ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, that's the general public, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders have a function. So a democracy isn't like a, you know, totalitarian state. The function of the ignorant, meddlesome outsiders is to be interested spectators of action, but not participants. They are supposed to lend their weight periodically to some member of the leadership class, that's called an election, and then they're supposed to return to their private concerns. Similar notions became part of mainstream academic ideology, democratic theory, to put it more politely, at the same time. In his presidential address to the American Political Science Association in 1934, we're now into the New Deal, William Shepard argued that the government should be in the hands of an aristocracy of intellect and power, while the ignorant, the uninformed, and the antisocial elements must not be permitted to control elections as they had in the past, he mistakenly believed, quite mistakenly. Actually, the foundations of the democratic polity, as described, for example, by James Madison in famous, or what should be famous, discussions, were that he was like Adam Smith. He recognized that society is divided sharply into economic classes with fundamental conflicts between them, and he said that the government must, this is in the Constitutional Convention debates, the government must be set up to protect the minority of the opulent from the majority who might seek a more egalitarian structure. That's the basic principle that government must achieve. I should say later in his life, Madison moved towards a more egalitarian view of the Jeffersonian type, but this is Constitutional Convention period. John Jay, the president of the Constitutional Convention, first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, his favorite maxim, his biographer writes, was that the people who own the country ought to govern it. The others are supposed to be observers. Since it's a democracy, they're allowed to, some of them at least, can lend their weight to one or another of the owners every once in a while, but that's it. One of the founders of modern political science, Harold Lasswell, he wrote in the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences in 1934 that modern techniques of propaganda, which had been impressively refined by Wilsonian liberals, provided the way to keep the rabble in line. He was pretty frank about it. Wilson himself, Lasswell described as the generalissimo of propaganda. His first scholarly work, Lasswell, was on the quite impressive propaganda achievements of Wilson during the Second World War. Lasswell wasn't the only one impressed. These achievements also greatly impressed Adolf Hitler. You can read about it in Mein Kampf. He felt that the Germans had been kind of wiped out by the power of Anglo-American propaganda, particularly by the generalissimo of Wilson, and he vowed that next time around they'd do it the right way. Perhaps more importantly, these achievements greatly impressed the American business community. That's what led to the huge expansion of the public relations industry, an enormous industry in American invention, spends billions of dollars a year on what it's advocates in more honest days used to call controlling the public mind, or into the 1950s, fighting the everlasting battle for the minds of men. As a political scientist, Lasswell urged more sophisticated use of these new techniques of control, as he put it, of the general public, the new techniques that were provided by modern propaganda. These would enable, he said, the intelligent men of the community, the natural rulers, to overcome the threat of the great beast who might undermine order because of the ignorance and superstition of the masses. I'm still quoting him. We must not, he said, succumb to democratic dogmatisms about men being the best judges of their own interests. The best judges are the elites, who must therefore be ensured the means to impose their will for the common good. That's Jefferson's aristocrats. Well, Lippmann and Lasswell and Wilson and so on, they represent the more progressive fringe of opinion as the new spirit of the age began to dominate. That grants the beast at least a spectator role. At the more reactionary end, you find those who are mislabeled conservatives in contemporary newspeak, so the Reaganite statist reactionaries, they denied even the spectator role to the errant public. That explains their fascination with huge clandestine terror operations. Why does a country carry out clandestine terror? Who is it secret from? Well, it's certainly not secret from the victims. They know all about it. It's not secret to the big terrorist network. For us, we're a big guy, not a little guy. We don't hire terrorists. We hire terrorist states. So the U.S. terrorist network in Central America, clandestine, so-called, included Britain and Taiwan and Israel and Saudi Arabia funding it and Argentine neo-Nazis and so on. Big terror networks. Not a secret to them. It's obviously not a secret to the victims. In fact, it's not even a secret to the press, but it's just low level enough so you can pretend you don't know about it until it becomes impossible. The main thing is it's got to be kept a secret from the domestic population, from the great beast. So clandestine operations are one of the many kinds of operation carried out by reactionary statists in fear of the great beast, who are not supposed to even be spectators, let alone participants. Also, the unprecedented measures of censorship and agitprop, which were developed by the Reaganites, finally declared illegal. These and other measures were an effort to ensure that the powerful and interventionist state that they nurtured would be able to carry out its international operations in secret from the great beast, and would also be able to serve as a welfare state for the rich, as it did, not troubled by the rabble. We see this very dramatically right at this moment in Congress under the leadership of Newt Gingrich, who quite demonstrably is the leading welfare freak in the country. I'll talk about it if you like. But if you think about it, he is the most avid advocate of welfare in the country, except he wants to go to the rich. His own district in Cobb County, Georgia, gets more federal subsidies than any suburban county in the country outside of the federal system itself. Like, doesn't get as much as Arlington, Virginia, which is, you know, where the Pentagon is and so on. But if you go outside the federal system, he beats it all, and it's supposed to continue because this kind of welfare dependency is good. You know, dependent children, that's bad, but dependent executives, that's good. You got to make sure they keep feeding at the public trough. In the same period, and especially in the 80s, there was a huge increase in business propaganda, another big assault on universities by right-wing foundations, all other similar tendencies. These are a further manifestation of the same concerns. They were a reaction to what liberal elites, to go back to the other side of the spectrum, to what liberal elites called the crisis of democracy that developed in the 1960s. The crisis of democracy arose when previously marginalized and apathetic sectors of the population, like women and youth and the aged and farmers and workers and so on, the parts that are supposed to be silent, began to become organized and to press their concerns in the public arena. And if you're naive and you believe what you were taught in eighth grade civics, that's democracy. But if you're sophisticated liberal, you know that that's a crisis of democracy which has to be overcome by driving the great beast back into its lair. And that's exactly what policy has been dedicated to ever since. If you think this is an exaggeration, I just urge that you read the original documents. I'm kind of understating it. In fact, in this trilateral commission conference, it's the liberal international elites, called the crisis of democracy, the American rapporteur, you know, the American contributors, professor, well-known professor of government at Harvard. In fact, he holds a chair, the title of which I love. It's called the chair of the science of government at Harvard. The science of government, as he explained it, teaches what I just described. And then he kind of looked back nostalgically to the days before the crisis of democracy arose, when, as he put it, a Truman was able to govern the country with the help of a few Wall Street lawyers and financiers. Then there was no crisis of democracy because the great beast was busy doing something else. But now the crisis arose, and so we got to go back to real democracy. Well, that's the liberal side again. John Dewey was one of the last relics of the Enlightenment and classical liberal tradition who opposed the onslaught of the Jeffersonian aristocrats. Whether they find their place on the liberal or reactionary parts of this very narrow ideological spectrum. Dewey also understood that politics, in his words, is the shadow cast on society by big business, and as long as this is so, attenuation of the shadow will not change the substance. This, incidentally, once again echoes what Adam Smith took to be a truism, that the nation is not an entity, that it's divided into economic classes, and that the architects of policy are those who have the economic power. In his day, he said, the merchants and manufacturers of England, who make sure that their interests are most peculiarly attended to, you know, well tended, like Gingrich, but whatever the effect on others, including the people of England. To Adam Smith, that was a truism. To James Madison, it was a truism. Nowadays, you're supposed to recoil in horror and call it vulgar Marxism or something, meaning that Adam Smith and James Madison must have been disciples of Marx. And if you believe the rest of the story, you might as well believe that. Those are facts which you can easily discover if you bother reading the sacred texts that you're supposed to worship, as I say, but not read. Well, into the 20th century, you know, you still have relics like Dewey, who recognized that politics is the shadow cast on society by big business. Reforms will therefore be of limited utility because democracy requires that the source of the shadow be removed, not only because of its domination of the political arena, which is trivially obvious, but because the very institutions of private power undermine democracy and freedom. And Dewey, like his forebears back to Adam Smith and others in the Enlightenment, right through the working class press, he was quite explicit about the anti-democratic power that he had in mind. So I'm quoting Dewey from the 1920s. Power today resides in control of the means of production, exchange, publicity, transportation, and communication. Whoever owns them rules the life of the country, even if democratic forms remain. A business for private profit through private control of banking, land, industry, reinforced by command of the press, press agents, and other means of publicity and propaganda, that's the system of actual power and the source of coercion and control. And until it's unraveled, you can't talk seriously about democracy and freedom. He then repeated standard themes of the 19th century working class press, saying that in a free and democratic society, workers should be the masters of their own industrial fate, not tools rented by employers. And he agreed on fundamental issues with the founders of classical liberalism and indeed with the libertarian and democratic sentiments that animated the whole spontaneous and independent working class movements from the early Industrial Revolution up until the time when they were finally beaten down, not that far back, by the force of concentrated private power and indeed violence. Going back to education, on the same grounds, Dewey held that it is, as he put it, illiberal and immoral to train children to work not freely and intelligently, but for the sake of the work earned. In that case, their work is not free because not freely participated in. Again, that's another version of the standard conception of classical libertarian thought and of the workers' movement. The artisan, the art may advance, but the artisan recedes. We may admire what the craftsman does, but we despise what he is. Same ideas all the way through. And Dewey therefore held, again, classical view, that industry must be changed from a feudalistic to a democratic social order based on workers' control and free association, traditional libertarian ideas from the Enlightenment right through modern anarchist movements. Well, as the doctrinal system has narrowed under the assault of private power, particularly in the past few decades, these fundamental classical libertarian principles sound kind of exotic and extreme, perhaps even anti-American, to borrow one of the terms of contemporary totalitarian thought. You'll notice that there's very few societies where such terms can be used. There are some. So in Stalin's Russia, anti-Sovietism was the worst crime that you could be accused of, anti-Sovietism. In the United States, anti-Americanism is a terrible crime. But in any society where there's the shreds of a democratic culture remaining, that would just be treated as ridicule. I mean, you try to, on the streets of Milan or Rome, accuse somebody of anti-Italianism. I mean, they'd probably collapse in laughter or something, or in Belgium or someplace, or in fact, any place where there's a residue of democratic culture still existing, whatever the forms may be. But in the Soviet Union and the United States, and I actually don't know of other, maybe Brazil under the generals or something, you can talk about things like that, like anti-Americanism. In fact, here there are books called Anti-Americanism, which are lauded and taken seriously. That's, an interesting insight into the actual nature of the culture. Well, in the light of this quite radical regression in intellectual culture, it's useful to remember that the kinds of ideas that Dewey was expressing, they are as American as apple pie. That's straight mainstream American thinking. He comes right out of middle America, but just from a different tradition, the tradition that has died, the tradition that existed from classical libertarian thought right through the 19th century and into the early 20th century, has origins in a very worthy tradition, at least in my opinion, one that's ritually lauded, although commonly distorted and forgotten. All of that is part of the deterioration of functioning democracy in the current age, both at the institutional and the ideological levels, at least in my opinion. Well, I've been talking about education a bit and other things, but education is only in part a matter of schools and colleges and the informal system. In fact, that's true whether the goal of these systems is education for democracy, as Dewey advocated, or education for obedience and subordination and marginalization, as indeed is the practice. But it's either way, it's just part of education, in fact, a small part. one leading University of Chicago sociologist, James Coleman. He concludes from many studies that, I'm quoting him, the total effect of home background is considerably greater than the total effect of school variables in determining student achievement. He estimates about twice as powerful an effect. So it's therefore important to have a look at how social policy in the dominant culture is shaping these factors, really the dominant ones in education. Well, that inquiry is facilitated by a quite important study done by UNICEF in 1993. UNICEF usually studies poor countries, but they did one recently, 1993, that studied rich countries. It's called Child Neglect in Rich Nations. The study is carried out by Sylvia Ann Hewlett, who's quite a well-known American, has been, I'm now quoting her, a disaster for children and families. The European model, in contrast, has improved their situation considerably from a starting point that's already considerably higher, and societies that incidentally lack the enormous advantages of the Anglo-American societies. The United States alone has unparalleled advantages in every respect. Therefore, the disaster for children and families and working people is particularly striking in the country, considering its options, which are unparalleled. This Anglo-American disaster for children and families, Hewlett attributes to the ideological preference for free markets. I think here she's mistaken, or at least half mistaken. Reaganite conservatism did advocate markets, but for the poor at home and abroad. On the other hand, it went way beyond its statist predecessors in demanding and winning a very high level of public subsidy and protection for the rich. They talked about free markets for the public, but when James Baker, Secretary of Treasury, was talking to business audiences, he boasted more accurately that the Reagan administration had given them more protection in violation of market principles than any preceding administration in the post-war period, which was true but overly modest. In fact, it was more than all post-war administrations combined. It roughly doubled protectionism in the United States, breaking records even for that protectionist decade. And that's apart from the enormous funneling of public funds to private power through things like the Pentagon system and so on, which is the main welfare system in the United States. That's why it doesn't change when the Cold War ends. It's got other functions, as the business world has always understood very explicitly. Whatever you want to call the guiding ideology, it's unfair to tarnish the good name of conservatism by applying it to this form of violent, lawless, and reactionary statism. However, Hewlett is right in part. She's right in identifying the free market for the poor as the source of the disaster. And there's a long history behind that. You go back to the 18th century and what's now called the Third World and the Industrial World were roughly equivalent. One of them was subjected to free market experiments. The other of them insisted on high levels of protectionism and state subsidy for private power, and the difference is dramatic, and it's virtually exceptionless. This is one of the few sort of near laws of economic history. And it works domestically as well. And she's right about talking about that consequence of the disaster, what she calls the anti-child and anti-family spirit that is loose in these lands. She's referring to the United States and Britain. This neglect-filled Anglo-American model, she says, based on market discipline for the poor, has largely privatized child-rearing while making it effectively impossible for most of the population, and the result is naturally a disaster for children and families, which she then records. In contrast, the much more supportive European-Japanese model, their social policy has strengthened rather than weakened support systems for families and children, and the results are quite different. And it's also no big secret. There was a 1993 Blue Ribbon Commission of the State Boards of Education and the American Medical Association reported that in the United States, and it's the same in England, but in the United States, never before has one generation of children been less healthy, less cared for, or less prepared for life than their parents were at the same age, though only in the Anglo-American societies, where an anti-child, anti-family spirit has reigned for about 15 years under the guise of conservatism and family values. That's a pretty impressive achievement. In fact, it's a great achievement of contemporary propaganda that it's possible to carry this off. Something that would have impressed even Generalissimo Woodrow Wilson, I expect. A symbolic expression of the disaster is that when Hewlett wrote in 1993, 146 countries had ratified the International Convention on Rights of the Child, but the U.S. had not. That's incidentally quite a standard pattern on international conventions on human rights. Today, it's 161 countries that have ratified it, and Congress still has not done so. Last year was the International Year of the Child, I should say. That's one symbolic expression. Incidentally, I should add, just to be fair, that Reaganite conservatism was quite Catholic in its anti-child, anti-family spirit, didn't just direct it against the beast at home. So the World Health Organization voted to condemn the Nestle Corporation for aggressive marketing of infant formula, which is killing many children, as everyone knows. The vote was 118-1. Guess who the one is. This is pretty minor, however, as compared with what the World Health Organization calls the silent genocide, which is killing millions of children every year as a result of free market policies for the poor and the refusal of the rich country to grant what literally amounts to pennies of aid. And again, the United States has by far the worst record among the industrial societies, the most miserly record with regard to so-called aid. That's an interesting fact and quite contrary to common perceptions created by the propaganda system, but easily determined. Another symbolic expression of the disaster is a new line of Hallmark greeting cards. One of them reads, "Have a super day at school." That one is supposed to be put under the cereal box in the morning after parents have gone off to work. Another one says, "I wish I had more time to tuck you in." That one, is, as they put it, is supposed to peek out under the pillow at night because the parents haven't gotten home. In part, this disaster for families and children is just the result of falling wages, and that's deliberate social policy. A state corporate policy has been designed to enrich a small sector and to impoverish the majority. It's now escalating, and it's succeeded in the past 15 years. The statistics show it quite clearly. So people just have to work harder. They have to work more hours, much longer to survive, and for much of the population, it's necessary for two parents to work, maybe 50 or 60 hours a week sometime, just in order to provide necessities. Meanwhile, corporate profits are sailing through the roof. Last year was a record year for corporate profits. The last quarter of last year was 60% higher than the preceding one. You know, the Wall Street Journal is falling all over itself in joy. 1993, the preceding year, was described by Fortune magazine as a dazzling year for profits despite stagnating sales. And that's even overlooking the major sources of capital, which are are speculative capital in places like Goldman Sachs and so on. So there's the business about a lean and mean age is total nonsense. Countries are awash in capital, but it's very highly concentrated. Wages are going down, but profits are going way up, exactly as intended, and current policy is intended to accelerate that tendency quite explicitly. Another factor leading to the same disaster is what's called job insecurity. There's a technical name for that. It's called flexibility of labor markets. Now, that's supposed to be a good thing. Labor markets are supposed to be flexible under the reigning academic theology. Labor so happens to be a rotten thing for human beings, but their fate doesn't enter into the considerations of sober thinking. Flexibility of labor markets means that when you go to sleep at night, you don't have to have a job the next day. And you don't have pensions and, you know, other rigid market rigidities. They're eliminated. If you've learned the lingo, you know what this means. That's true. And indeed, when both parents are working extra hours or else, then you kicked out because there's no security. And for most with falling incomes, it doesn't take a great genius to figure out what the consequences are going to be, and the statistics show them. Contact time between parents and children has dropped precipitously in the past generation, maybe about 40%, 10 to 12 hours a week, she estimates. And high-quality contact time, when parents are really spending time with one another, has dropped very, very sharply. And that has obvious effects. It leads to destruction of family identity and values, a sharply increased reliance on television for child supervision, latchkey children, leave the kids alone, with rising child alcoholism and drug abuse, a lot of more increased violence by children and against children, and all the other obvious effects on health and education and ability to participate in a functioning society. At the same time, what's called welfare, we don't call welfare what goes to rich people, but we call welfare the little trickle that goes to poor people, and that's declined very sharply, contrary to what's being said. So aid for families with dependent children has dropped precipitously since 1970, I think it's about halved since then, and that has the obvious effects, breakdown of families, illegitimacy, inability to take care of children, the general disaster in the neglect-filled Anglo-American model. In Europe and Japan, where conditions are in fact more stringent, they don't have our advantages, but policy is not guided by the same anti-child, anti-family spirit, the tendencies have been in the opposite direction. And the standards for children and families are indeed much better, in fact, improving. And you don't have to even compare us with Japan. Take Europe. Take the simple matter of leave for working parents. Here it's not fathers, just working mothers when a child's born, maternity leave for childbirth. U.S. standards are now below those of plantation workers in Uganda, believe it or not. That's where we stand in the anti-family, anti-child spirit that reigns in the land. In Europe and Japan and even Uganda, there's a strong trade union movement by our standards. That's one aspect of a more fundamental difference. The United States is a business-run society to quite an unparalleled degree for all kind of historical reasons. And as a result, the vile maxim of the masters prevails to an unprecedented extent as well, despite the extraordinary wealth of the society, which is totally unparalleled. You have this third world character developing that you just don't find in other industrial societies outside of England, which is pretty much like us. Well, these are among the means that allow democracy to function formally. Though by now most of the population is consumed by what's called anti-politics, hatred of government, disdain for political parties, and for the whole democratic process. And that's also pretty dramatic. So about half the population in the United States thinks that both political parties should simply be disbanded. About two-thirds of the population, as you know, don't bother voting. And of those who vote, still more interestingly, those who vote, most of them vote against their interests and know it. If you look at exit polls, it turns out most people are opposed to what they're voting for. In the last elections, in which the Republicans got about maybe 18% of the electorate or something, bare majority of the minority that voted, one out of six voters said they were voting for the Republican agenda, or even knew what it was. To put it properly, one out of six said it was an issue in their vote. Some for it, some against it. So if you want to be charitable, maybe 5% of the population granted the overwhelming landslide mandate that we hear about. In addition to that, over 80% of the population regard not only the political system as gone, but they regard the economic system as inherently unfair. But this is just the great beast, and their attitudes are irrelevant once policy is insulated from politics. Well, all of this is a great victory for the aristocrats in Jefferson's sense, those who fear and distrust the people and wish to draw all powers from them into the hands of the higher classes. By now, that means into the hands of transnational corporations and investment firms and so on, and the states and the quasi-governmental institutions like the World Trade Organization and the IMF and so on that serve their interests. Another great victory is the fact that disillusionment, and there's plenty of it, the country's very angry, disillusioned, frightened, and so on, it's taking the form of anti-politics. That's interesting. So you read, a headline in the New York Times says, anger and cynicism well up in voters as hope gives way. Mood turns ugly as more people become disillusioned with politics. Well, they had a whole Sunday magazine section devoted to anti-politics. Notice that the opposition, it's not opposition to power and authority. It's not opposition to the quite easily identifiable forces that have their hands on the levers of decision-making. They are invisible in this commissar culture. All you see is what Dewey called the shadow. So Dewey's observation that that politics is the shadow cast on society by big business, again, a truism to Adam Smith and James Madison, that's now become invisible. It's just another aspect of the degeneration of the cultural system. The force that casts the shadow has been removed from the ideological institutions, and it's so remote from consciousness that we're left with anti-politics, that is, opposition to the shadow. There's plenty to be opposed to in the shadow, but that's not the problem, as was understood from, say, Adam Smith up through early 20th century mainstream liberals. All of this is another severe blow to democracy and, in fact, a grand gift to the absolutist and unaccountable systems of power that have reached levels that a Thomas Jefferson or John Dewey could scarcely have imagined. Well, today we have a choice. We always have a choice, and those of us who are lucky enough, and most of us are lucky enough to have a choice, we can choose to be Democrats in Thomas Jefferson's sense or aristocrats. The latter path is the easy one. It will bring rich rewards, given the locus of wealth and privilege and power and the ends that it quite naturally seeks. The other path is one of struggle, often defeat, but also rewards that cannot even be imagined by those who succumb to the new spirit of the age, which is the same now as it was 150 years ago, gain wealth, forgetting all but self. Today's world is far from Thomas Jefferson's. The choices that it offers have not, however, changed in any fundamental way. Thank you.
Hi, this is Roger Leisner for Radio Free Maine, and you've been listening to Noam Chomsky speaking on education and democracy, recorded on March 28, 1995 at Michigan State University. For a copy of this tape, please contact Roger Leisner, Leisner, in care of Radio Free Maine, Post Office Box 2705, Augusta, Maine, 04338. Or call area code 207-622-6629. That is also a fax number. We now join Noam Chomsky for the question and answer period.
What are my thoughts on tax resistance? I happen to think the United States is seriously undertaxed. The problem isn't, I can see the point of tax resistance if it's trying to block the F-22. So you give the what taxes are being used for, yeah, and those sensible people should pay it. I myself was involved in tax resistance for years. On the other hand, speaking more generally, it seems to me the problem is the opposite. By comparative standards, the country's undertaxed, and it's also regressively taxed. The tax burden falls mostly on the poor.
And what we need is a progressive tax system of, incidentally, the kind that Jefferson advocated. You know, traditional libertarians like Jefferson advocated sharply progressive taxes because they wanted a system of relative equality, knowing that that's a prerequisite for democracy. Jefferson specifically advocated. We don't have it anymore. It's sort of there in legislation, but it's gone. What we need is different social policies, and social policies which ought to be funded by the people who are going to benefit from them. That's the general public. So we'd be a lot better off if we were better higher taxed and it was used for proper purposes. And we know what those are. I mean, for example, for women taking care of children. You know, it makes sense to pay them for that work. They're doing important work for the society, and they should be paid for it. You know, and it's but that requires tax payment. And the same is true about protection of the environment. You know, you want a place where your children are going to be able to survive, you better take care of it now, or else we'll get another Georgia Spank and another one and so on. But again, that's the way public funds ought to be spent. They should not be spent for Newt Gingrich's rich constituents. By international standards, we're undertaxed. This is one of the least taxed countries. Furthermore, contrary to what people believe, low taxes have nothing to do with growth. I mean, there's plenty of evidence on this. We are undertaxed, but also overtaxed, because the taxes we pay go for the wrong things. See, it doesn't. The numbers themselves don't mean anything. You know, you could have very low taxes all going into the pockets of Goldman Sachs, and we would be overtaxed. You can have very high taxes and it going for useful purposes, and we might be undertaxed. The question is what the policies are. Exactly what the level ought to be, that ought to be subject to democratic discussion and debate, which it is not. Yeah. The question is, and it's a sensible one, whether devolution, you know, that means moving power down to the state level and away from the federal government, couldn't that be a step towards democratization, as in fact the Gingrich guys claim? It could be under certain conditions. It isn't under these conditions. And the reason it isn't is because what's being overlooked is that there's a huge system of private tyranny. And given that there's a huge system of private tyranny, weakening the public role, which is what happens, simply gives more power to private tyranny. Let's be quite concrete about it. Take, say, Massachusetts, where I live. Middle-sized businesses in Massachusetts are now threatening that they're going to leave to go to Tennessee or someplace like that unless they get more what amounts to welfare from the state. Okay? You know, whether it's tax subsidies or tax reductions or subsidies or one thing or another, and they can do that. They can play one state against one state public against another. You have to be General Motors or Microsoft or something to threaten the federal government with that. So the private tyrannies are there, and they do, like General Motors does play one national workforce against another. That's why they move their assembly plants to northern Mexico and Poland and so on instead of Flint, Michigan. But that's for the big guys. You know, the big tyrants, the big private tyrannies can play that game. But even minimal private tyrannies, smaller ones, can play this game. And that's why things are going down to the state level. Now, unless you change that, by putting things down to the state level, you're simply putting more power into their hands. So there's perfectly clear examples of this. The federal government passed a transportation bill some years back, I forget, like 5 or 6 years ago, and the idea was for federal money to go for purposes of transportation, and it was sent to the states. Okay, 96% of it was sent on automobile-related transportation. Is that because that's what people want? No. What most people want is mass transportation you can pay for. I mean, by now, poor people can't afford to take the subway. Like in Philadelphia, where there's now a strike, subway costs are $1.50 a ride. I mean, who can afford that when you're going to go to work? You know, first you got to take your kid to the daycare center that you can't pay for, and that costs $1.50, and then you go to work, and it's another $1.50, and then you come home, you know, you lost your day's salary. Well, 96% of the funds are going for private transportation, okay, or either airports, which is for a tiny group of rich, really, or for highways for the trucking industry, for the motor industry, basically. That's not the first time that's happened. You know, it also happens on the federal level. But the point is, and the purpose of it was to be distributed. You know, and it's not satisfying the purpose, and the states can do that. And they're under private pressure to do it from the construction lobbies and, you know, other relatively small industries. So you're right. In principle, it could be a democratizing thing, and indeed it would be the right thing, in my opinion, if we didn't have private power around. But you cannot ignore the fact that there's this, big substance that's casting a shadow over everything. Ignore that, and you're not talking about the real world. And in the real world, putting things down in the hands of the states means you're just submitting them to that power, which eliminates whatever limited role the public still has. So yeah, in some other world, you'd be right. And we ought to, I think, try to create that world, but we don't have it now. The question, two questions. One, how could I call myself a libertarian socialist? Was it a contradiction in terms, given the meaning of the term libertarian in the United States? And secondly, if I'm opposed to state-subsidized capitalism, what about laissez-faire capitalism, the kind advocated by Adam Smith, right? Well, you're right that the terms that I'm using are contradictory in the United States, but that's a sign of the perversity of American culture. Here, the term libertarian means the opposite of what it meant to everybody else all through history. So what I was describing was the real Adam Smith and the real Thomas Jefferson and so on, who were anti-capitalist and called for equality and thought that people shouldn't be subjected to wage labor because that's destructive of their humanity, and the real Adam Smith, who said that in any civilized society, something has to be done to prevent division of labor because it'll turn people into creatures as stupid and as ignorant as it's possible for a human to be, and who advocated markets only on the grounds that under perfect liberty it would lead to perfect equality. Okay, that's the traditional libertarian tradition that I've been talking about, and in that sense, yeah, I'm a libertarian. The U.S. sense is quite different. Here, every word has taken on the opposite of its meaning elsewhere. So here, libertarian means extreme advocate of total tyranny. That's what libertarian means here. It means power ought to be given into the hands of private, unaccountable tyrannies, even worse than state tyrannies, because there the public has some kind of role. The corporate system, especially as it's evolved in the 20th century, is pure tyranny, completely unaccountable. You're inside one of these institutions, you take orders from above, you hand it down below. You're outside the institutions under what the libertarians want. There's nothing you can say. The tyrannies do what they feel like. They're global in scale. I mean, this is the extreme opposite of what's been called libertarian everywhere in the world since the Enlightenment. And that's what's called libertarian here. So, yeah, it is hard to talk here because, like, you can't use words like libertarian or conservative or anything because they've all come to take their opposite meaning. As for Adam Smith and Wealth of Nations, well, you know, first of all, the idea of a unsubsidized, not state-subsidized capitalism, we don't even have to bother talking about that. It has existed. It exists in a good part of the Third World, which is why the Third World looks the way it does. It has never existed in any developed society for a very simple reason. The wealthy and the powerful won't allow it, just as Adam Smith understood. They will use the levers of power to make sure that state power subsidizes them. That's why England developed, that's why the United States developed, that's why France developed, that's why Germany developed, that's why Japan developed, and in fact every developed society has developed just that way. That's one of the cliches of economic history. So we don't have to talk about that because it's non-existent, it never will exist, except for people who have it rammed down their throats. Now, am I in favor of it? That's another question. Like in some mythical world, would I like to see laissez-faire capitalism? Well, only under the conditions described by Adam Smith, the real Adam Smith, you know, the one who wrote Wealth of Nations, not the one you worshiped before, but the one who wrote it. And if you look at his argument for markets, it's pretty clear. I mean, maybe the argument's right, maybe it's wrong, but it's clear what it was. The argument was, I repeat, that under conditions of perfect liberty, markets will lead to perfect equality. That's why markets are good, he said. They will lead to perfect equality, and they will not force people to subject themselves to outside orders, so they become less than human. so that the artisan recedes while the art improves, as de Tocqueville put it. Yeah, if that were possible, maybe so. But it's not in the cards. And I don't know if that argument works anyway. It probably doesn't. You know, the argument was fallacious. But the goal was clear. The goal was a society based on Enlightenment values, which is just radically opposed to what today are called libertarian values here in the United States. So there you have to be clear about what you're talking about. But you're right. As I use the terms, it sounds contradictory in the United States. Like it also sounds contradictory in the United States when people ask me what I think about conservatism, and I say I think I'm probably one of the few conservatives around. Because I actually believe in traditional values. I don't know anybody on public arena who does. So I don't know, to the extent that the term has any meaning, I'm probably a conservative. You know. But that doesn't mean much here. You know. We have to start by decoding a whole system of intellectual distortion before you can even talk. That itself is a big achievement. You know, if terms have lost their meaning, well, you know, it becomes impossible to talk. And that's itself an achievement. Doesn't have to happen, and you know, people with privilege and education can help it not happen.
Hi, this is Roger Leisner for Radio Free Maine. For a free copy of a Radio Free Maine catalog featuring both audio and video tapes, please send a self-addressed stamped envelope, 75 cents postage, please, to Roger Leisner, Leisner, Post Office Box 2705, Augusta, Maine, 04338. Thank you, and so long from Radio Free Maine.